Blog Talk Radio.
What?
Well, that didn't work out so good. Thank you.
Erie House is brought to you by the letter Z and the number pi.
I love pie.
We love pie. Oh, better than cookies. Give me pie. Ooh.
That went over like a lead balloon. Good evening and welcome to Erie House Radio. I'm Dale K from Spook Show, accompanied by
Dave Binkley from Weirdness, Really Bad Movie, and Spaceship One, and we're here with...
Hello, hello. This is CW telling you to trust your mail to your local carrier pigeon. It'll get there a darn sight faster.
Could be. Very much so.
And I'm Greta Garbo.
Yep. Yes, you are. Had to use the wonderful cell phone tonight to come in and control the show.
We're not going to let anything shoot us down here on Erie House except ourselves. So, tonight, it's not letters like the alphabet, but rather the stuff you get sometimes in the mail.
Yeah. And hello to good old Bob and Foxbane in the chat.
Yep, we're not just mailing it in today. Here we are, here for the duration.
That we are, and we got three, count them, three thrillers for you. A couple of detective type stories.
Yes. And Sam Spade and Richard Diamond.
Yeah. All right. The deck is stacked.
It is. And an episode of Mysterious Traveler, too.
Right. And we should have a little extra time tonight because both Sam Spade and Richard Diamond, I believe, are Armed Forces broadcast. So all the commercials got yanked because they wouldn't air those over the Armed Forces Radio and Television Network. And a fun thing, Sam Spade and Richard Diamond, although different characters are in many ways alike, they're both fun shows, and they're serious and funny at the same time. Because a lot of times there's death involved, but the characters themselves, with both Howard Duff and I don't know why his name escapes me at the moment. The Richard Diamond, the singing detective. They're both serious, but
Powell?
Sarcastic.
Powell?
Dick Powell. Thank you. Thank you. They're just the characters themselves are funny but serious. Then the shows are serious but have moments of fun in them. And the Sam Spade is really a fun one tonight, I'll tell you.
They're the hard-boiled detectives with a snappy comeback.
Yeah. Yeah, some of them aren't funny. Like the Michael Shane wasn't really funny it was a good show, well-written, and had both Jack Webb in it and, this is not my name night, I'm telling you.
Name that detective?
It'll come to me.
Name that detective.
Are you talking about Mickey Spillane's My Camera?
No, that was another very basically straightforward, serious one, as was the Michael Shane private detective, Jeff Chandler. That's the one I was trying to think of.
Oh, very good.
I'm thinking that the Mike Hammer, one of the Mike Hammers was, I think, Mandel Kramer, I think. I'm not sure.
I'm always partial to Sam Shovel.
Sam Shovel, yeah. Which is a thing that Lou Costello really enjoyed doing. Because it was so far away from their usual stuff.
If you want a really good spoof on all the best detectives, Neil Simon's Murder by Death is
fabulous.
Standing.
Fabulously funny movie. Yes.
You could be in the worst mood in the universe, and if that doesn't get a laugh out of you, you're 25 days dead, and even that's not an excuse.
It is a funny piece of work, and we're going to deliver, as it were.
Yeah, as it were. Yeah. Hopefully, though, we'll deliver to the right address this time.
Yeah.
Indeed. So, as the military always screamed, mail call, mail call, mail call.
Yeah, that was a fun little show. They, unlike the command performance, they kind of themed up mail call. So that was really, it was a variety show, but they kind of themed up different things about it. And so that was really kind of cool about mail call.
True.
And a call out real quick to our buddy. We hope he gets well soon, our pal Gar the Ghoul.
Yeah, he's had a very rough week and a half, and then gets smacked down with a migraine. So good thoughts coming your way, buddy. You get over this stuff.
Yeah, kidding.
We're rooting for
you. Vibes, healing vibes.
Yep.
Yeah, Dale and I both talked to him separately this week, and he was really hoping to be here, but it just isn't going to happen tonight.
But he's here in spirit.
Absolutely.
He is.
Every show, he's always here with us.
In our hearts.
Aww.
And on our minds. And let's not be unmindful of our programs tonight. So maybe, like you said, Dave, we'll probably have a little bonus time at the end of the night for some bonus radio stuff.
So why don't we start off with, I think that Sam Spade is such a fun show this time. And I think Sam, half the time in the show, Sam Spade doesn't know what's going on himself. So.
Well, that's a great place to start. And this episode is called The Love Letter Caper. This ought to be a hoot.
And it is from March 27th, 1949.
The Adventures of Sam Spade, Detective.
Since the world began, woman was meant for man.
Well, Sam, I must say, this is the shortest honeymoon in my experience.
Yes, have you been keeping something from me?
I wouldn't blame myself if I did. It didn't exactly telegraph this punch.
Come on in, Angel, and I'll tell you as much about it as I think you should know.
And what, may I ask, is a large parcel with a pink ribbon around it?
Love letters. What else?
Well, I must say, for a whirlpool romance.
Whirlpool?
I mean, writing all those letters. When did she find time to get acquainted?
Stop pulling at that blouse. What's the matter? Does it itch?
Sam, now that your marital status is no longer quo, well, damn these little routine informalities. Don't you think we should be a little more stilted with each other, yeah?
In the hereafter? Then, perhaps, and not a minute before. To Sergeant Joseph Walsh, Bunko and Fugitive Detail, San Francisco Police. From you-know-who, license number 137596. Subject, the... easier. Subject, the love letter caper, or how to be happily married, though single. The start of it was last Wednesday morning. I had just arisen, shaved, bathed, weighed myself in the bathroom scales, and decided on a breakfast of black coffee and rye crisps. Noisy stuff. Oh.
Spade! Cash and delivery. Sign here.
Oh, now hold this, will you, Sonny?
Yeah, but what do you call this? Some kind of Italian soda cracker?
Rye crust, low in calories. Take a bite.
Oh,
you're
going
to lose a pound or two yourself. Mm. There you are. Eat the change.
Thanks. I'll smoke it after dinner.
The first thing that fell out of the envelope was a photograph, glamour type. It was inscribed to Sam, body and soul, Ella. The letter was in the same tone of voice.
Sam. Sam. Oh, Sam, my darling. Last night was so beautiful, but now my arms are empty and I'm filled with strange fears for the future. Unless I see you soon, I don't know how I can go on living. Come to me tonight, my darling. Wait until the house is dark. Then slip in through the west gate and I'll meet you beside the fountain. If you fail me, I don't know what I'll do. But I know you won't. All my love forever. Ella.
I read it over again, looked longingly at her picture and shook my memory down. I couldn't even remember ever meeting a girl named Ella, but I did remember that last night was definitely not beautiful. In fact, I had dropped $35 in a blackjack game, not deductible. After I had tested the letter for invisible ink, codes, and ciphers, etc., with negative results, I decided it was either A, a crank letter, or B, bait, or C, a camouflage call for help from a damsel in distress. I took another look at said damsel's photograph and decided I would investigate her distress. I then phoned my secretary and told her to look up the night bus schedule to Atherton, the return address on the envelope containing said love letter. It was around 11 in the p.m. and the moon was just clearing the treetops behind the Comstock mansion when I slipped in at the west gate per the instructions in Ella's love letter and took a plant beside the aforementioned fountain. The house was in darkness and I didn't see the ladder until the moon cleared the chimney pot. There was a girl climbing down the ladder from the second story and she had a suitcase in her hand. When she reached the ground, she looked around anxiously, spotted me, and flew into my arms.
Sam! Oh, Sam, my darling, you didn't fail me. Oh, my precious, hold me. Never let me go. I love you.
I love you, too, but now look.
I'll explain it all later. We'll have to hurry. I think he suspected something.
Who suspected
Please,
what?
Please, there isn't time. Come
Who's
on.
That?
The watchman. We'll have to go out the back way. Come on.
Hey, there. Come back here. Hey, you.
Hey, hold it. Get down.
No, let me go. We've got to get out of
here.
I
said get down.
No.
Shut up.
Comstock. They had a ladder up to the second story, the hall window.
But I scared them off.
Oh, not all. Well, let's have no more shooting. I'm trying to scream.
Yes. Come on. It's our last chance. If you looked in that room, I love you.
I love you. What room?
Wait, well, my room, of course.
Where are you planning on going?
Anywhere, just so I get away from him. I love you.
I love you. Who's him?
My uncle. He's been holding me prisoner in that house.
Oh, come now.
I tell you, he's insane. He'll kill us both if we're caught, so please, come on.
I went, because A, I don't like being shot at, and B, there was a wild possibility that she was indeed a fairy princess and the lamb from a dragon. I discounted half of B when we reached her getaway car. It was parked in the alley with a motor running. When she insisted that I drive, I hesitated whether to head directly to police headquarters or nail her the stupid way. I was weak from being on a diet, so it was Hobson's choice, more familiarly known as Spade's Folly. It's where I live.
You wouldn't lie to me.
Not about that. Look at the address. Your love letter arrived here. Come on. Here, let me carry your bag.
No, it's all right. I'll carry it.
Come on. It's okay. No cops, no booby trap. Now, let's have a look in that suitcase.
No, you mustn't.
Come on. Give it to me.
Oh, no, you can't.
Why not?
Because you'll get the wrong idea. Oh.
Well. What have we here?
I knew you'd get the wrong idea.
The only thing you seem to have missed is the Hope Diamond.
That jewelry is mine, every piece of it.
Uh-huh.
It's all I have in the world.
Poor kid. Let's see now. Diamond bracelet, not more than 10 grand. Emerald necklace, second hand, of course. All told, I don't imagine this stuff will net you a penny more than $100,000.
I know, but I'll just have to get along as best I can. I don't have any money of my own.
Yeah, why did you write me that crazy love letter?
Because my uncle reads all my moves. I didn't want him to know I was hiring a detective.
Why did you?
I couldn't very well walk around with all these jewels without some protection, could I? Oh, my uncle, he followed me here.
Suppose it's the cop.
Oh, no, it's he. I know it. Where can I hide?
In here?
Don't you have a bedroom?
Yeah, but it has a window and a fire escape in here. Go on.
Go on.
Faith?
Yeah.
I suppose she's told you about me.
You were uncle?
Oh, good heavens, no. I'm Stuart Mason. I'm a fiancé. Or was, till she ran away with you.
Maybe you'd better step inside, Mr. Mason.
Thank you.
Sit down. I'd like to...
No. I just brought a few things I'd like to leave for Ella. Here. This bundle of letters. Her love letters to me. I suppose she'll want to destroy them.
Now, wait a minute, Mr. Mason. Don't jump to any rash conclusion.
I saw her come down the ladder. I saw her throw herself into your arms.
Yeah, but...
I can't blame her. I've been a coward. I told myself it was for her own sake that I discouraged her from escaping with me. But now I know that... Well, it was at least partly fear for myself. But I might die as the others did.
Yeah, but... What others?
The men she's known. They've all died under mysterious circumstances, and... Didn't she warn you?
Well, all she told me was that her uncle was insane and wouldn't let her out.
Crazy like a fox. As long as she remains unmarried, he controls her money. $3 million of it.
Uh-huh.
Well, only the brave deserve the fair. Alas, if you'll just give her these letters and tell her that I...
You tell her yourself. Come on out, Ella.
Stuart, why did you come here?
Your letters, my dear. And I wish you every happiness.
Stuart.
You too, old man. Good night.
Well, Stuart. Stuart, darling, I can explain everything.
Don't try, my dear.
But Stuart, come back.
Hey, Ella, your jewelry. Your love letters. Hey.
We'll take care of those letters, Spade. Keep the gun on him, Riley.
Inside, you. Over there, sweetheart.
What do you want?
Mr. Spade, I've been aware for some time that you've been carrying on a surreptitious love affair with my niece.
Look, Mr. Comstock.
Watch him, Riley.
Don't worry, Mr. Comstock.
I advise you against trying to jump him, Spade.
Why should I? You're both nuts, but not crazy enough to take a shot at me here.
Try me and see.
I wouldn't waste the energy. I haven't made a penny on this caper so far, and it doesn't look like I will.
Ha! Not a penny, he says. The king's ransom and jewels extorted from a foolish, lovesick girl.
Oh, how did I manage that?
Don't you play the innocent with me. This packet of love letters will satisfy the police. Blackmail.
You're crazy. Those letters weren't written to me.
You deny that Ella has ever written you a letter?
One too many. In fact, one.
Well, how do you explain these? Darling Sam. Sam, my dearest one.
What?
Sam, my great, big, beautiful detective. Dated last October.
Hey, let me see those
Watch
things.
It. I told you not to move.
Yeah, so you did. Well, what now?
Very well. Give me the police department. Yes, it is. Hello? This is Hugo Comstock. I want to make a complaint. Blackmail. Oh. Hello. I want to... Yes, Sergeant. The name is Hugo Comstock, and I'm making this complaint on the behalf of my niece, Miss Ella Comstock. The name of the offender is Samuel Spade, a private detective. Huh? Well, of course I'm sure. Yes, I'm holding him at his apartment now. The address is... you have it. Well, I'm not surprised. You better hurry over here right away. He's threatening violence.
You really think you can make that stick?
Mr. Spade, I'm sure I can.
Dirty words and foul imprecations were forming on my trembling lips. But he had letters from his niece to one Sam, a great, big, beautiful detective. And I had the jewels, and before the night was over, Sergeant Walsh, you had me. Booked, bothered, and bewildered. What bewildered me was how to raise the $2,500 bail. Sam Spade, innocent dope. I mean dupe.
The United States Armed Forces Radio Service is presenting the weekly adventure of Dashiell Hammett's famous private detective, Sam Spade.
And it is. We're looking to back on, checking how Dale is on his headphone connect.
No.
Which we don't hear. Oh, CW, are you there?
Yes.
I
am here.
We're on. Yes.
I am here.
Dale,
can you hear me?
There?
I am here.
I
Hello?
Can hear you.
Hello?
I can hear you.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes. Howard Duff, quite an amazing guy. What a great voice, known for as much for his, I guess, eyebrows as anything else. You didn't notice that on on radio, but you did notice it on television and on that era, movies. It never really considered an iconic movie.
No, more of a journeyman actor. Sort of. Yeah, so more not more of a leading man sort of type, not akin to Alan Ladd, but more of a journeyman sort of actor in the cut in the vein of, say, Rod Steiger or Richard Kiley, something like you always know who he is. You know him by his voice. You know him by sight. That sort of actor. Very good character actor. Always could make the smallest role really, really meaty, if that makes any sense.
The first thing I ever saw him was in the Felony Squad on television. He was one of the co-stars in that. And I think of mid-1960s, 66, 67, I was watching him in that. And that was probably my first introduction to Howard Duff. I think he did some great radio roles, even including a Lights Out episode, which became the special to Hollywood, where they were flying along. We've aired that here on Erie House, where they were flying along, and then all of a sudden, the plane stopped in midair. It was just stuck there, you know. A great Arch Obler a bit. So
that was very Twilight Zone-ish, that episode.
It was. And he did do a Twilight Zone episode where he was a person and ended up on stage as an actor on a TV show, but he didn't think he was with the TV show, or he wasn't with the TV show, although everything was written out for him and such. So I think they kind of thought they was having a nervous breakdown. It was a world episode called A World of Difference. Yeah, wonderful job on that.
Nice.
He also did an eye gallery. I think it was called There No More McBains or something like that. I think he was in Joel Grey. He and Joel Grey were in that episode. How's that for a cast?
Very tasty. Nice. And remember his, at the time, better half was Ida Lupino, a wonderful performer in her own right, and one of the first women to really sink her teeth into a directing in Hollywood.
Never forget the
and
lost
she directed,
woman.
And she directed television as well. Matter of fact, she was the only woman to both direct an episode and star in an episode of The Twilight Zone.
That's right. Very, very iconic.
I forget which episode she directed, but she starred in the episode called The 16mm Shrine, where she was an old movie actress who was living her life through the movies and ends up going into the movie at the end. One of the 16mm movies she had of one of her old movies.
Wonder if that was inspired by another great film, Sunset Boulevard.
It may have been. But
I know
he did have a. Go ahead.
I was going to say it's also akin to an episode of Columbo, about a fading actress who wants a comeback and commits murder. That was with Janet Leigh, actually. Jamie Lee Curtis's mom.
And Ida Lupino was in at least two Columbos. One of them, she was married to Johnny Cash, which he killed her off early in an airplane.
Hilarious. Columbo's introduced to Squirrel Stew. When he's out, when he's trying to question him, and someone asks him, would you like a plate? Makes him a plate and says, oh, wow, that's tasty. That's good, isn't it? That squirrel. And the look on his face pauses over for him.
a pilot that it was never sold. Actually, it was more than just a pilot. There were several episodes. 1958. It was a detective mystery series called The Green Peacock, and that was following the cancellation of the comedy series that he and Ida did called Mr. Adam and Eve in 1957. And even though episodes were produced, they were never broadcast, and they were written by Daniel Manwaring, William Spear, one of the great radio writers, directors, and directed by Alan H. Milner, and Raymond Navarro was the co-star in that. So the pilot and several episodes were made, but it was never aired. I'd love to get a hold of some of those.
Must be drifting around somewhere on the net, somewhere. Someone's got it. So if someone out there has it, just post it someplace.
Dave will hunt them down and find them.
And also, unfortunately, Howard Duff was injured by the Red Scare around the 1950s and lost some radio work because of it.
Yes, and if it had not been for his wife, Ida, connecting with him and forcing them to do things together, he may not have worked for a decade or so, like many of the Red Scare artists were ruined off their media.
Yeah.
So she just, for there weren't any direct accusations, but for some reason, his name was in some kind of ledger somewhere, supposedly. The whole Red Scare thing was a fake thing anyway.
Yep.
But
it was
mostly a way to stop the actors from organizing and unionizing. That's what it was about more than anything else. And it was the writers and the actors that really went after. No one else really seemed to be affected.
No, it didn't get any big directors, at least none that I ever heard of. You know, the big muscled Warner Brothers or MGM or 20th Century Fox or whatever, you know, was out there at the time.
Interesting.
But actors and writers, yeah, and there was a whole group of them. Matter of fact, the Robin Hood series was American actors that went over to England, and they wrote the series and sent the writing back to the U.S. where it was filmed.
Cool.
Oh, wow. I had no idea about that.
So you just...
Hey, it's a way to get it done.
Yeah, I guess so.
It is.
Yeah,
man, we
got
to get done with Sam Spade as we wrap up our first program with the Love Letter Caper.
Brought to you by Rye Crisp.
That's right. And the letter Q.
Up the times into my breakfast of rude prison fare. They didn't serve any Rye Crisp, but what they did serve was even less fattening. I thrust my emaciated arms through the bars of my cell and clawed at the lapels of a passing bondsman and begged him for succor. He says I didn't need any because I was it. I hurled him aside and sat down to think. About then, you, Sergeant Walsh, hove to in front of my cell.
Okay, Sam, get moving. You're free.
Gee, thanks. Who stood my bail?
Great kidder, aren't you?
Sergeant, am I to understand that the charges have been dropped?
Get out of here.
All right, I know when I'm not wanted. Mine not the reason why.
And don't come back!
Your inhospitable words cut me to the quick, Sergeant, but I bit my lip, swallowed my pride, very low calorie, and strode bravely out into the sunlight, a free man, I thought, until I bought a newspaper. Right there on page one, it said, heiress reveals secret marriage to private detective. Blackmail charges against Sam Spade dropped. All a mistake, says Uncle. Next to the item was a picture of Ella leaning over a hot stove in my kitchen. It was captioned, Surprise Bride Prepares Breakfast for Incarcerated Mate. We'll keep things hot for him, says Mrs. Spade.
Sam, darling, your breakfast is ready.
I'm on a diet. Take off that apron and sit down.
I did it for your sake, Sam, darling.
Wouldn't it have been simpler just to have dropped the charges?
Oh, it wasn't difficult. The nicest man forged the license and the certificate for only $10.
I know a guy who would have done it for $5 and thrown in some fingerprints for free, but that's not the point.
But, darling, don't you see? If you'd just gone free without being married to me, Uncle Hugo might have done something worse to you, like kill you.
Nuts. Who are these ex-admirers of yours who were supposed to have been knocked off by your uncle? Name three.
Well, there was Ralph Bettinson. He died of vapor loss.
Of what?
It happened in the mountains. Something went wrong with his car, but they couldn't prove it because it blew up and burned after it went over the cliff.
Hmm.
And then there was poor Freddie Push. They called him the piggy bank suicide.
Why?
They found $5 worth of pennies in his stomach.
Oh.
And And then there was poor Nicky Notto. He was a ballet dancer.
That's enough. Now, about those letters. Why was your friend Mason returning love letters you'd written to some detective named Sam?
Well, that was just coincidence. He always went by his initials, you know, like GBS for George Bernard Shaw, SAM is for Stuart Andrew Mason. Stuart Andrew is his pen name. He writes detective stories.
And the rest of the coincidence was that love letter you inadvertently mailed to Sam Spade Detective, thereby sending your uncle out gunning for Sam instead of SAM.
What could I do after he read my diary and my confessions to myself about SAM and the references to his brilliant mind on criminal subjects? You were a natural stand-in for S.A.M.
Pronounced S.A.P.
But I wasn't going through with it, Sam. Not after I met you.
Why not?
Because the moment I saw you, I knew that all those things I'd said in that love letter were really true.
Really? Last night was so beautiful?
I think I must have dreamed of you.
Exactly.
Oh, Sam, darling, I'm so lost and frightened.
Hey, man.
You don't know what my life has been.
Oh, I can imagine. Boyfriends dropping dead right and left.
You're the only one who can stop it. If Uncle Hugo thinks we're really married and he can't use my money anymore, then he'll stop having accidents happen to people. Won't you please be my husband, Sam? Is that so much to ask after what I did for you?
Yeah. Go on. You spring me out of that blackmail frame so I can help you compound a felony.
But, Sam, what am I going to do?
You forged a marriage, go forge a divorce.
Where are you going?
Back to jail. I'll see you there. Ow!
Oh! Oh, dear me. Hit your foot, did it? Cast iron. Don't make them like that nowadays.
My foot.
Your foot. I meant the strong box.
Oh.
Oopsie. Coming in or going out?
I think I'll sit down for a minute.
Sam, you poor dear boy. Here, let me take off your shoes so it can swell if it wants.
Get away from me.
I only wanted to help. I love you.
Well, I don't love you anymore.
Oh, first little fat, is it?
Who is this guy?
Oh, Sam, I'm sorry. This is Curtin.
You can say that again.
Curtin. Harwood L. Curtin, L. for Lacey, attorney at law. I represent the estate of the late Gertrude Comstock, Ella's mother. You, Mr. Spade, have married into, shall we say, money?
Look, Curtis, it's time to raise the blinds on a couple of things. In the first place...
Please. As you know, Ella, your grandfather, the late Commodore Ezra Comstock, left his fortune to be divided equally between his legitimate heirs, that is, your mother and your Uncle Hugo. Upon your mother's death, the residue of her part of the estate was left to be administered by your Uncle Hugo as he saw fit until your marriage, at which time it should go to you.
Well, where is it?
Yeah.
All in good legal time. First, here is this old strong box.
You mean strong box?
Containing family mementos handed down to you from your grandmother. It was your mother's wish that this be delivered into your hands upon this auspicious occasion. Here is the key, in addition to which I leave with you both my best wishes for your future happiness. Good day. Mr. Spade, I shall forward along to you the statement of my fees for services in this case.
Wait a minute. Who's paying my fees?
No more questions, please. Good day.
Well, I guess we might as well open it.
Oh, I'm sleepy.
Oh, no. Let's see what's in here.
All right. Let's. It didn't take long to go through Grandma Comstock's mementos, and I got more and more wide awake as we went along. The strong box contained four items: a teapot, a bundle of letters, a photograph album, and a family skeleton. The letters were love letters from one Elmo Pinckney. That was a tintype that said Pinckney in the album. He was a dead ringer for Uncle Hugo, which might have been a coincidence, but wasn't. I started scanning through the love letter.
Find any money yet?
Huh? Well, there's a Confederate 10 spot. I'll let you know if I hit any pay dirt.
Well, at least she left me a pot to make tea in.
What?
But if there wasn't any money, why wouldn't Uncle Hugo let me get married?
Now, look, why don't you go and wash out that pot and make some tea, huh?
Probably least. Oh, something in it.
Hmm?
No money. His grandmother's marriage certificate and mother's and Uncle Hugo's birth certificate.
Let's see those.
Oh, crap. I might have known. I wonder who that is.
That will be your Uncle Hugo.
Well, that doesn't need to worry us anymore, does it?
Yeah, put these things back in the teapot and put the teapot on the mantelpiece.
But it's cracked.
So am I, so do it anyway. Come right in, Uncle Hugo. You too, Cousin Riley, you fool.
Very funny.
Now, now, don't be silly, Riley. Ella, accept your poor old uncle's blessing on this happy occasion.
I don't want your blessing, Uncle Hugo. You're a mean old man, and you killed all my fiancés.
Well, it appears that Mr. Curtin's has already brought you a legacy. I believe I recognize your grandmother's strong box. Mementos of a strange romantic chapter in the history of a great family, Mr. Spade. You, who have joined that family so unexpectedly, will have a privilege that even I was never granted.
Oh, how come?
My mother was a strange woman in some ways.
I'm sure she was.
I suppose we shall never know what prompted her to leave these personal oddments to Ella's mother, nor why my late sister chose to keep their contents a secret from me. I don't suppose I might be allowed to just a peek into that Pandora's box.
Go ahead, help yourself.
Really? Well, there's nothing but a photograph album and a bundle of letters.
Love letters, Uncle Hugo. They seem to run in your family. Would you like to read them?
You have no objection, Ella.
Me?
Why should she have? But I can give the whole story to you in a nutshell, Uncle Hugo. It seems that Grandma Comstock fell in love with a handsome rascal named Pinckney, a deserter from the Confederate Army, and eloped with him to New Orleans. Her family pursued her there, had Pinckney arrested, got an annulment, and whisked her back home in time for her scheduled wedding to Ezra Comstock. These letters were written to her by Pinckney while he languished in prison awaiting court-martial. Here's the last one. Read it for yourself.
Oh. Lydia, my darling, in a few hours I face a firing squad. Please, no tears, no regrets. I'm glad that you are married to a man who is worthy of you. Comstock will be a better father for our child than I would ever have been. Farewell, my love. Huh. So that was a secret. Nothing so extraordinary about that.
I think it's very tragic. Think of her married to a man she didn't love, about to have a child, and her lover facing a firing squad.
Nonsense. Sentimental nonsense.
What do you know about such things?
I should know a little. After all, I was that child.
Oh, I'm sorry, Uncle Hugo.
Wow. Fine old piece of stone.
What?
This teapot. I don't remember seeing this here before.
Just something I picked up in a junk shop.
Very rare piece. Do you mind if I look at the mark?
Go ahead.
The genuine example. Piteous crack. Now that was clumsy of me. Well, it's no good saving the pieces. I'll just toss them in the fire.
Wait a minute, Comstock. I'll take care of it.
Oh, it's no trouble. Well, what's this?
It's your birth certificate, Uncle Hugo.
Give me that.
Oh,
no. What are you going to do with it?
Put it back where it came from.
Roddy.
Yeah, Mr. Comstock.
Spade, I'm going out of here, and I'm taking that strong box with me. And don't think I won't kill you to get it.
He will, Sam, just as he did the others.
And you, too, if you don't shut your trap. Hand it over, Spade.
Sure. Come and get it.
Okay, let's have it.
There you are.
Riley, what's wrong with you?
Oh, my foot is broken. Oh!
Sit down and rest it.
Oh.
Hold it, Comstock. I've got the gun now.
Well, Spade, seems you've won the day. How does it feel to be a rich man?
You'll have to tell me, Comstock. The reports of my marriage to your niece are slightly exaggerated. And that's about it, Sergeant. I'm sorry I can't furnish you with the forged papers Ella used to back up that phony story of her marriage to me. A fire broke out in the wastebasket, and I accidentally dropped them into it. As for Comstock and his gunsel Riley, I will gladly press charges against them on the blackmail frame until homicide decides whether there's a case against him on the mysterious deaths of Ella's previous fiancés. Period. End of report.
But, Sam, why?
Why what, if?
Did he want that old cracked teapot?
Well, because grandmother's love letters plus the documents on that teapot prove that Hugo was not a Comstock, but a Pinckney, and hence not entitled to one red penny of the Comstock fortune, which was left, if you recall, to Grandpa's legitimate heir.
Well, who was? Entitled, I mean.
Ella, but if she never married, she'd never find out,
but
you see.
But she doesn't deserve it.
Hmm?
After making a pigeon out of you the way she did.
I agree, sweetheart, but how else could she afford to pay my fee?
Well, I certainly hope you so
can. I fully intend to. Go type that up while I falsify an expense account. No, still a couple of fingers in there. Break out another glass.
Oh, no, I meant the expense account.
Oh, that. Well, it was nothing much, just bus fare. Free breakfast in the pokey? Nah, no, that would be tough.
Well, I took the liberty, Sam, of drawing up a statement. Did you look it over?
Yeah. Hmm. New letterhead.
Well, it's only a sample I had, dummy.
Huh?
Sending your approval. Do you?
Well, yes, very classy. I like the coat of arms, but I'm not quite sure about the motto.
Oh, but Sam, you are the greatest private detective of them all.
Well, you know best, Effie.
And then, for an extra $1, we could have it printed in Rady ink.
In what?
Luminous ink, Sam. Shines in the dark.
Even as you and I.
Oh, Sam. I'm glad you're still a bachelor.
Go home, all the same.
Good night, Sam.
Good night, sweetheart.
The Adventures of Sam Spade, Dashiell Hammett's famous private detective, are produced and directed by William Spear. Sam Spade is played by Howard Duff. Loreen Tuttle is Effie. Adventures of Sam Spade, Private Detective, is a presentation of the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.
And that does it for our Sam Spade episode. I think I heard Dale. Did I hear Dale?
Oh, I'm here.
You were here? Dale? We're all three on, but Dale's having trouble with his headset tonight, so we'll get him to call back in for this.
All right. So even though the Armed Forces Radio Network scoured all the commercials out, good old Rye Crisp was mentioned more than a few times, so I'm of the considered opinion that was the sponsor of the hour.
Approved by the Armed Forces Radio Television Network.
Network.
And as a result, let me see, I think this is what this is. Let me see. And in a slow response time on Erie House Blog Talk Radio, here is a garrulous moral of the story. With apologies to Gar, a phony love letter could lead to a phony marriage, which may lead to a real divorce of the situation. And I don't know. I don't know where that is. Any kind of soundbite. Any soundbite.
Tarzan.
Going to be a good night.
There you go.
Well, besides that, it could be a good night. Anyway.
I got mail. Radio. Yay. I got mail. Yay.
Mail's in.
There you go. Where shall we go next? Dale. I guess it isn't working yet. So shall we do another detective or shall we go to the mysterious traveler?
Oh, I think that another detective in the house is warranted. Another gumshoe, another private eye, and Seamus. You know, hard-boiled.
Well, in that case,
or slightly
up
overused.
To Richard Diamond, private detective, as CW reminded me, Mr. Dick Powell, because my brain is not functioning today, who had just come off of the radio series Rogue's Gallery, where he played Richard Rogue. Here he plays Richard Diamond, private detective, and a whole different kind of, very much the same thing, very tongue-in-cheek, but not, he actually chose this. He had the opportunity, and he did a pilot for the very first pilot for Johnny Dollar. And
oh,
he had
wow.
the choice between Richard Diamond, and he really liked what this young writer had for Richard Diamond. And that young writer was Blake Edwards. And it went on to
oh.
so many wonderful things in radio,
Pink
television.
Panther's father.
And movies. The Pink Panther's father. Exactly. So, as soon as I get down here to the parts, oh, go back up to the parts. And do this.
Yeah.
Be a, you know, there's Dale. There's
I
Dale.
Dale. Dale. Hey, there you are.
Never
yeah,
give up.
Boy.
This studio has a call-out feature. So I called me.
Ah. Did you answer yourself?
I did. Hello, me. It's me. Not that I'm needed. You guys are carrying well without me as we do get ready to move on to Richard Diamond.
Indeed. Richard Diamond played by Richard Powell, a la Dick Powell, same guy who played Richard Rogue. There's a pattern somewhere there.
And then he did this thing called Dick Powell's Dane Gray's Theater. Boy, that guy was had something about using his name all over the place, didn't he?
Yeah. Love the sound of his name.
So anyway, Dale, anytime you want to strike that button, this particular episode of Richard Diamond actually was episode number 72, and it came to us originally from November 8th, 1950, and nothing, it's 1950.
Dead Man's Letter.
Richard Diamond, Private Detective, starring Dick Powell.
Diamond?
Yeah? What's the matter?
You got to do something for me.
Hey, you're hurt.
Yeah.
Hey, now take it easy. Sit down.
Oh,
sit down.
You got to listen to me.
You're bleeding all over the place. I'll call a doctor.
No, please wait.
But look,
I've been knifed. I've been knifed bad. I don't think I've got much time. Here. Take this. They're right behind me.
I'm going to call a doctor.
No, listen. Key or quest. Get envelope to the...
Hey, you. Oh, no. The man, whoever he was, had toppled over on his face and was very dead. He handed me a plain white envelope, sealed with no address on it. I went over to my desk to put in the call to homicide when I heard someone moving around in the hall. I turned and saw the shadow of a man silhouetted against the glass section of my office door. I grabbed a pen and hurriedly scribbled the address of Lieutenant Walter Levinson, 5th Precinct Homicide, on the envelope, stuck a stamp on it, then headed for the hallway. I was about to open the door when the shadow was joined by another one. They opened it for me. Excuse me, Dylan.
Wait a minute. We want to ask you...
Later. I got
to
mail a letter.
Hey, stop him! Don't let him mail that thing!
They were both big men and could run. I beat them to the mail chute by a split second and dropped the envelope. They made a dive for it, and when they missed, they forgot it and started concentrating on me.
Diamond.
Diamond. Diamond, please try and sit up.
What happened to you?
Oh, where are your wings, honey?
You look as though someone had beaten you up.
No, don't be silly. It's the latest thing. Hey. Back in my office.
I found you lying here. You want me to call a doctor?
No, call homicide.
Well, someone did?
Certainly. That guy right over...
What guy?
Oh, Dandy. Well, honey, there was a guy. In fact, he was lying just about where I'm lying, and he was dead. Look, you can see the blood.
I thought that was your blood.
Well, rather than try and convince you, maybe you'd like to tell me why you came up to see me.
Well, my name's Nancy Lang. I want to hire you.
To do what?
I'm giving a big party tonight, some very wealthy guests. I just want someone around to keep an eye on things.
Well, I'd like to help you, but I've got a bit of a problem with a missing body.
Oh, that's too bad. I was prepared to pay you $500 for the evening.
$500? Well, so a body gets lost. Who wants to hunt a corpse when he can attend a perfectly good party? Well, good afternoon, Sergeant Otis.
Oh, how are you, Diamond?
Still breathing. Why don't you try it sometime?
Oh, go jump in the lake.
Only if you lend me one of your shoes to paddle around in.
No.
Hello, Walt.
Hi, Rick. Oh, no. What happened to you?
Well, two charming gorillas used me for a fast game of squash.
Who were they?
Never saw them before. But I got a hunch they killed the guy. Let's have a look at your mug file. I gave Walt the story and told him about the mysterious envelope he would be getting in the mail. But after 2 hours of checking the rogues gallery, we came up with nothing. So I went home, shaved and changed, and went out to my client's house, where she met me in a well-appointed library. Her appointments were,
Mr. Diamond, right on time. You look much better.
Well, I tried to wear something that wouldn't clash with my bruises.
I'd like you to meet Senor Giardo.
Giardo?
An old friend, a very wealthy politician from South America. This is Mr. Diamond, Mr. Giardo.
How do you do, sir?
How are you, Mr. Giardo?
Mr. Diamond is a private detective. He's here to guard the wealth.
How very interesting.
Kind of an official watchdog, Mr. Giardo.
Well, there will certainly be enough to guard. Miss Lang's guest list is made up of some very wealthy and prominent personalities. In fact, I am very flattered to be among them.
I've seen you before.
Very possibly. Have you ever been to South America?
A couple of times, but that's not it.
My home is in Bogota.
No. Well, it doesn't matter. I'll think of it.
If you'll excuse us, Mr. Giardo, I want to show Mr. Diamond around the house and grounds.
Certainly, certainly. A pleasure meeting you, Mr. Diamond.
The house was my father's. He died several years ago. He used to love this garden.
It's beautiful.
Smell the jasmine?
Yes.
What made you become a private detective?
Oh, I don't know. I make a pretty good living. My own boss. I was a cop for a long time. I like to work. Now, that's quite a fountain. Trying to give Rockefeller Center competition.
It looks beautiful with the lights on. There.
Yes, it certainly does.
You're not the type to be a private detective.
Oh, I'm definitely the type. Sure, like everything else, it gets dull sometimes, but when things start popping, it can get pretty interesting.
Like this afternoon, getting beaten up. The man you said was killed in your office?
Well, he wasn't killed there. He just died there. Besides, how many guys can wake up lying on their office floor and have a beautiful girl offer them $500 to come to a party?
I see what you mean.
Don't you think you'd better get back? Your guests are probably arriving.
Yes, I'll switch off the fountain lights.
Why don't you leave them on?
My father used to sit and watch it for hours. I don't like to show it to everyone.
Kind of like a part of the garden died.
You certainly are a strange man.
Never noticed myself.
Well, I have. I like you.
Where did you meet Mr. Giardo?
In South America. He was a good friend of my father's.
Wealthy politician.
That's right. Mr. Diamond.
It's Rick.
Rick?
Yeah.
Oh.
I think we'd better go back to the party. I'm a fairly normal guy. Nancy was a very exciting girl. And the kiss in the garden was as nice as anybody could ask for. But there's one thing I do pride myself in. That's a certain lack of stupidity. There was something wrong. Nothing I could put my finger on, but I sensed it. Like being lost in a dark room with a loose high-tension wire. I circulated around, and nothing out of the ordinary happened. By 3 o'clock, the party broke up, and Signor Giardo and Nancy were the only ones left.
A most enjoyable party, Miss Lang.
Oh, thank you. It was nice of you to come, Signor Giardo.
Well, I must say good night. Have you remembered where you have seen me before, Mr. Diamond?
Well, not yet, Mr. Giardo.
Oh, too bad. Thank you again for a charming evening, Miss Lang. Good night, Mr. Diamond.
Good night.
Good night. Oh, God.
little beat my shouts.
You want some coffee?
Love it. We had some coffee and Nancy drove me home. I kissed her goodnight and left with a promise to call. As I reached my floor, I could hear my phone ringing. I opened the door and stumbled into the biggest mess I'd seen in a long time. My room was a wreck. Someone had torn it to pieces. Yeah?
Diamond?
It's 3:45 in the morning. What do you want, Fatty?
We fished a body out of the river about an hour ago. Died from a knife wound in the back.
Did he fit the description of the guy who died in my office?
This one didn't fit any description. Someone was very careful to fix his face so we couldn't identify him.
Check his fingerprints.
You're playing around with some pretty gory individuals. They amputated his fingers.
Somebody's given my room a good going over. Really took it apart. It's an odds-on bet they were after that envelope. And when you get it tomorrow morning, give me a call. It might tell us everything we want to know.
Okay.
Walt, you ever heard of a man named Gallardo? South American, supposed to be mixed up in politics?
No, why?
Nothing. I met him at the party tonight, and I...
Who is this?
This is Lieutenant Levinson. Who is this?
Mr. Diamond is unconscious.
What?
And if you ever want to see him alive again, listen carefully.
Okay, go ahead.
From Mr. Diamond's conversation, I understand you are to receive the envelope. When you do, go directly to the Staten Island Ferry. Ride on it all day if necessary. A man will meet you and pick up the envelope. Be alone. Do not notify the police, or Mr. Diamond will surely die.
Someone had sapped me and sapped me good. I had a dull, throbbing headache, and when I began to find my way back to consciousness, I felt my coat pulled off and my right shirt sleeve rolled up. There was a sharp pain in my upper arm, and several seconds later, my headache disappeared in a surge of heat that spread out over my back and shoulders. I tried to fight it, but it was like being on a sinking ship, trying to crawl back up the slanting deck. The ship dragged me down, and I swallowed up in the black water. Next thing I remembered was a blinding circle of light overhead, like the sun if you were looking at it through a sheet of wrinkled cellophane. I shut my eyes and I could hear voices. Far off, hollow, not making much sense. The light hurt my eyes, but I couldn't seem to shut it out. So I tried to relax and wait, give the drug time to wear off. After what seemed like hours, the voices began to make sense. The light was easier to look at. It was just a plain ceiling lamp. As the feeling in my fingers began to return, I realized I was lying on a bed.
There's a restaurant on the corner. I won't be more than 10 minutes.
The other man had promised to be back in 10 minutes, so I had to do something in a hurry. I kept tightening my muscles, trying to get the circulation back. I had to make a try. I wasn't sure of my strength, but I had to try. I rolled off the bed.
Hey! Hey, coming out of it, huh? Trying to break your neck?
He leaned down to pick me up, and I hit him just below the Adam's apple with the side of my open hand. The man choked and turned blue. He grabbed for his shoulder holster, and I kicked out with both feet. He doubled over and fell on his face. The effort had put him out of commission, but I was exhausted. I grabbed his gun, staggered for the door. But getting out of that room was like wading through an acre of glue. I made the hall somehow and started down the steps. I met the other man coming up. His arms were filled with beer and sandwiches. I shot him right through his dinner.
Almost. We can hear you just lightly.
How about now?
Same.
Nah, it's the phone.
Are we back?
There you go. Oh,
there
yeah,
we go.
Hello?
Yes, we're back.
Hello?
We're all back. You're back, CW. We're seeing
thanks
if we can get Dale on tonight's show or not.
Have I lost you?
No, can you not hear us, CW?
I don't think Blog Talk is having a heck of a time
back
with us. She just dropped,
Blog Talk,
she'll be back, we hope.
Yeah, when Dale, just before the show started, Dale sent me a message. Blog Talk is working rather slow tonight, and that could be part of your problem with your headset. I sent you a message, Dale, to check out in between the next segment here. But, yeah, got shot right in his dinner. Boy, I'd rather be shot about anywhere else but there.
True enough. Audacity. We'll talk about this later. All right, I have the audacity to let CW back into the studio. Are you back,
here
young lady?
We are.
Have you returned?
CW?
We see you.
Okay.
Well. Thanks again, Blog Talk. You're doing a wonderful job for us. Thank
a
you.
A wonderful
so much.
Job tonight. Oh, my.
Beer and sandwiches, the
yeah.
horror, the horror.
While you were gone, CW, we explained that Dale mentioned before the show even started how Blog Talk was running slow. So, she's gone. Hopefully she'll be back.
Slow like a
and
short
maybe
bus.
We should be gone.
Anyway.
Maybe we should be gone so we can come back again. And maybe none of us will be here. Who knows next time?
We don't know.
Oh, there she is. Check and see if she can be heard.
Are you
can
with
we
us
hear
now,
you,
young
CW?
Lady?
No, yep. Your voice is not coming through.
Yep. Well, gang,
okay.
We'll just wrap up Richard Diamond and cross your fingers.
No.
One or more of us may
there
be
you
back.
Are. There you are.
After
you're
this.
Back. You're back.
Feel better?
Yeah, Walt. A little more coffee, huh?
You really had a rough time. They pumped you full of this stuff.
Yeah, I'm amazed. I was out nearly 14 hours, huh?
Yeah, you lost a whole day. How you managed to get down here, I don't know.
I guess I'll never know.
Drink your coffee.
Yeah. And, you gave them the envelope, huh?
Yeah, about an hour before you staggered into the station. I rode that ferry all day. 5 o'clock, a man came up to me, and I gave him the envelope. Oh, I was smart. I had 3 men on the ferry and 3 men at each landing to tail him. He was a little smarter. He took the envelope, stuck it in a waterproof case, and jumped overboard. Fast speedboat picked him up.
No identification on the guy I shot?
No record. Nothing on him by the time we got there. What did the other guy look like?
I was so punchy, I couldn't tell much. You'll have a sore throat for a long time.
But they were the ones who beat you up yesterday at your office.
They were.
When you feel like it, I want you to take a look at that guy we dragged out of the river. See if you recognize his clothes or anything. He just might be the one who died in your office.
All right. Now, what was in that envelope?
Well, I had a photostat made before I took it to the ferry. Looks like part of a map. Here.
Hmm. So this is what's caused all the trouble. Boy, it must be worth a lot.
Can you make anything out of it?
Water, section of land, and here's a longitude reading, but no latitude reading.
Probably on the other half.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it. Well, I've got a hunch about this. I want you to send Otis over to pick up Nancy Lang, then take me over to the newspaper office and help me look at the files for something on a man named Guiardo.
You know what you're looking for?
Yeah, this guy Guiardo, Senor Guiardo. I know I've read about him or seen his picture. Hey, Walt.
You find something?
Yeah, here he is. But his real name isn't Guiardo, it's Ortiz. Yeah, look at those headlines.
Julio Ortiz assassinated. Rebel leader killed after plot to take over government failed.
Yeah, listen to this. Ortiz was expecting a large amount of American dollars to finance his army. Although the rumor is not confirmed, it was reported that Artes shipped $1 million in gold bullion to someone in the United States. The plane was supposed to have crashed, and it is interesting to note that the recent plane crash in which two American pilots escaped, John Bishop and Bernard Combs, were found floating off Key West. Key West? Holy smoke, that's what the guy in my office tried to tell me. He said Key West before he died. Huh. Well, don't you see? Ortiz is still alive. Maybe those two pilots double-crossed him and hid the gold. That's what that map is all about. I'll 8 to 5, that man you've got down in the morgue is one of those pilots. John Bishop or Bernard Combs.
I'll have the FBI send us the files on both those guys. If one of them is John Bishop or Bernard Combs, we won't need fingerprints nor a face. We'll check their dental records, birthmarks.
Well, let's get back and see if Otis has got the lovely Nancy Lang.
That's right, Lieutenant. She ain't in town. She's gone on a vacation, a butler said.
Did he say where?
No, he said he didn't know. He said this Miss Lang left town about 4 o'clock this afternoon.
And I'll bet she's with Ortiz. Walt, when you talk to the FBI about those two pilots, have them check Nancy Lang, too. I'm going to Key West. Send any information to the chief of police there.
Well, I'm glad to know you, Diamond. We just got a teletype from the lieutenant identifying the body. It was Bernard Combs, one of the pilots.
Hmm. Well, here's the half of the map. Tell me, does that look like any section of coastline around here?
Well, now, that's hard to say. I'll have a check.
You ever heard of a man named John Bishop? He's the other pilot.
Oh, sure. When them two boys was found floating around, they brought him into Key West.
Mm-hmm.
They was in the hospital here a couple of days. Bishop still lives in Key West.
Well, I hope so. He may have died here very recently.
And you think this here Ortiz is in Key West, too?
I'll bet on it. He wants the other half of that map and may have it by now. He's got to go after that gold. You'll need a boat and some diving equipment.
Well, what makes you think the gold's in the water? This map's got a shoreline, too.
Well, those two pilots couldn't carry $1 million in gold bullion. It either went down with the plane or they dumped it and then bailed out and let the plane crash.
Well, I'll get Bishop's address. We'll go over and have a talk with him. On the next floor.
Well, I hope you're right.
Well, that's where he's been living. Right down here. Bishop? Hey, Bishop. Door's locked.
You got a pass key?
Yeah. Bishop, you... Lord have mercy.
Yeah. Is that Bishop?
Yeah, that's him. Boy, he sure is dead.
Well, that accounted for the two pilots. So now all we had to do was find Julio Ortiz. It figured he now had both sections of the map, and his next move would be to hire a boat and diving equipment. There weren't many places in Key West where a man could rent a boat and diving equipment. So the chief rounded up his men, and we all started checking. It didn't take long.
No, Captain. Party hiding my ship ain't come back yet. We ain't due to sail for an hour.
What did the party look like?
Pretty girl. Can't figure what she wants to go diving for, but I just ran them to keep my mouth shut.
Probably Nancy Lang. Ortiz is staying undercover until the last minute.
Well, I'll spread my boys around. We'll keep out of sight. And when they show up, Skipper, you don't say nothing about us.
Sure. I just ran them to keep my mouth shut.
About ready for that boat to sail.
Well, they'll wait till the last minute.
Just imagine $1 million in gold, just like a pirate story.
Not enough killings mixed up with it to be one. Hey, hold it.
Is that them?
Yeah, that's Nancy Lang. But Ortiz isn't with her.
Who are them two fellas?
I've never seen them before. Some of Ortiz's men. They're probably checking to see if everything's clear before Ortiz comes aboard. We got as close to the schooner as we could and waited. The two men walked over and checked the diving equipment while Nancy Lang went below. We kept waiting, and still Julio Ortiz didn't show.
Hey, they started an engine.
I don't see Ortiz anywhere.
They're casting off.
We better take them.
Yep. We're going to have to jump.
Look out for that one. He's got a gun.
I got him jumped.
The other guy's running forward.
Stop, you!
He's going over.
Well, my man will pick him, huh?
Yeah, I'm going below.
Captain, what's up,
Mom? Hello, Nancy.
How did you find him?
Where's Ortiz?
I don't know who you're talking about.
Is this the girl?
Nancy Lang meets Key West's chief of police.
How do you do?
Where's Ortiz?
She says she doesn't know who he is.
Okay, young lady, I'm going to hold you for the New York authority.
Hold me for what?
Murder. John Bishop and Bernard Combe, so we can make it stick.
It might go easier on you if you tell us where Ortiz is at.
I still don't know any Ortiz.
Guillardo, the man I met at your party.
That's ridiculous.
Now, look, we know all about the gold. You don't have a chance of raising it, and eventually we'll get Ortiz.
Yeah, we're back at the dock.
If you don't help us, Nancy, it's pretty sure you'll get life for complicity.
And if I do help?
I can't promise a thing, but it will make a difference with the court.
Julio's waiting 10 miles down the coast. We would pick him up, then go out and raise the gold.
He has the map?
Yes.
I'll tell the skipper to shove off again. We'll sail that 10 miles and grab Ortiz.
What's your connection with Ortiz, Nancy?
He's my husband.
A dozen police officers came aboard and hid below decks. The skipper put out to sea and sailed parallel to the coast. Nancy told me all about her husband and his history as a rebel leader in South America.
I was stranded in South America with a show that folded. I married Ortiz. After the gold was lost, he faked assassination and came to the United States. He located the two pilots. My husband was suspicious, so I played up to the one who came to your office. I got him drunk one night, and he told me about the gold and his half of the map.
We've gone to 10 miles.
I'm glad it's over with.
I see a man standing on the beach.
Mr. Diamond.
Yes?
I was supposed to lure you into that garden.
Figured.
What I said at the fountain. I really... Oh, forget it.
Yeah. No sense making it any tougher. We pulled into a cove and got as close to shore as possible. Then we swung a dinghy over the side. The chief and I climbed in behind Nancy. We kept our hats down over our faces and hoped Ortiz wouldn't notice until it was too late. We both rowed and kept our backs to him. Nancy sat in the stern facing us.
Rick.
Yeah? We headed right. I don't want to turn around.
You're headed all right. Rick, my husband has always been good to me.
Well, I'm glad he was good to somebody. He sure made a mess out of a couple of guys I can think of.
But he was good to me.
Hey, we're nearly there.
Hello, darling.
Hello. Julio?
Yes?
The police are with me.
Why, you stupid little...
He's running for it. Save the girl.
Let him go. My men will pick him up.
I got a score to settle. Ortiz, stop.
Okay.
Well, that makes the assassination permanent.
Diamond Private Detective stars Dick Powell in the title role and was written by Blake Edwards with music composed and conducted by Frank Worth. This is Bill Foreman speaking. Richard Diamond Private Detective is transcribed in Hollywood by Jaime Del Valle. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
And that's going to be it for our Richard Diamond Private Detective episode. And CW,
and I'm
are you there?
Back. I'm back. I'm back.
You are back. Yes.
I am
back.
Go. Yay.
And
it wouldn't let me call
is...
through. Yeah.
Gone and I am again. Front and center.
Oh, hey.
And there. Hey, it's a trio once again.
Hey, bravo. Yay, yay.
Long
talk. Thank you for nothing. Yeah, for some reason
I guess Dale.
Bring in.
You know, we saw you, but we couldn't hear you. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's your problem.
Oh, well. CNI Radio.
There you are.
Anyway.
But,
Dale, there may be something that possibly we could maybe learn from this story of Richard Diamond, private detective.
I'd probably learn it a lot faster if I get my finger a scrolling as we go. Eerie House Radio sadly presents a garrulous moral of the story.
With apologies to Gar. Sometimes, if you are dead, you should just stay dead. Otherwise, you may get killed. There you go.
Eerie House Radio is brought to you by the letter Beta.
The letter Beta. Oh, we're going to get that. Oh, wow. Great.
Beta was a great format.
Oh, gosh.
And Blog Talk is a great format.
When it works, it is.
So, it is. Yeah, when it works, which is most of the time, frankly, just not tonight. But I digress.
Thanks, Blog Talk.
Thank you, Blog Talk.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Sounds like the kids on Married with Children. Thanks, Dad.
Thank your father.
Thanks, Dad.
Thanks, Dad.
Loser shoe man.
Speaking of Shoeman, I don't know what that has to do with anything, but we do have yet one more exciting episode going on tonight, Dale.
Coming down the pike on the Pony Express.
Oh, jeez. Everything's falling apart. Two or three pair of headsets flying everywhere, I'll tell you, gang. It's chaos at Eerie House as we do move on over to Mysterious Stranger. Do we have a broadcast date? If we did we already say it?
We did not. Mysterious Traveler, the broadcast date for that is, what was that? January, March, May 18th of 1948.
Death Writes a Letter.
Mutual presents The Mysterious Traveler.
This is The Mysterious Traveler, inviting you to join me on another journey into the realm of the strange and terrifying. I hope you will enjoy the trip, that it will thrill you a little and chill you a little. So settle back, get a good grip on your nerves, and be comfortable, if you can, as you hear the story I call Death Writes a Letter. My story begins last summer in the townhouse of Martin Drake, a well-known financier. Martin is deep in argument with his older brother, John, as his daughter, Susan, enters the room unnoticed.
John, how can you possibly believe in such things? Spiritualism, nonsense is a better word for it.
To a skeptic, everything is nonsense. But if you'd seen and heard what I have, you too would believe.
Hello, Father. Uncle John.
Hello, Susan.
Oh, I see you two are up to your old arguments.
Well, your father's a very stubborn man, Susan.
Well, I may be stubborn, but I'm no fool. Imagine believing in spiritualism, telepathy, and all that tommyrot.
I believe in spiritualism, Martin, and that the living can communicate with the dead. And nothing you can say will swerve me from my beliefs.
Uncle John, in all these years you've been studying spiritualism, have you ever been able to communicate with Aunt Judith?
No, Susan, I haven't. But there have been times late at night when I've all but broken through the barrier that separates us.
Oh, I give up. There's no use in arguing with a man who has an obsession.
Oh, that's fine, Father. Now the three of us can go into supper.
Oh, I'm sorry, Susan, but I can't stay for supper.
Oh, why not?
I have an appointment with an honorary critic.
A what?
An honorary critic, a man who's an interpreter of dreams.
John, good grief, don't tell me you believe in that, too.
Why not, Martin? For years, psychoanalysts have interpreted dreams in an effort to help their patients. The subconscious minds of the living can sometimes bridge the vast gap of death.
Now, John, I'm warning you. If you don't give up this obsession of yours, there's no telling how you'll end.
I know you think I'm cracked, that all the years I've spent studying spiritualism have been wasted, but you're wrong. The living and the dead can communicate with each other, and someday you'll realize I'm right. Now, I really must be going or I'll be late.
Well, Uncle John, you will drive up to the country with Father this weekend, won't you?
Oh, are you opening the summer, please?
Yes, I'm driving up tomorrow to open the house and engage some servants.
Well, I'll try my best to join your father this weekend.
Oh, that's fine.
Don't bother showing me the door. Good night.
Good night, Uncle John.
Good night. To think that anyone in this day and age still believes in spiritualism, particularly your Uncle John, it's incredible.
I don't know, Father. Uncle John seems so sure of himself that sometimes I feel he may be right.
Oh, Susan, that's nonsense.
But look, Father, if it's all nonsense, why should Uncle John believe in it? You yourself have often said he's the most brilliant man you know.
And he is. It's just that, well, we all have our eccentricities, and John's is spiritualism. Until his wife died 5 years ago, he was just as sane as you or I. No living person has ever communicated with the dead, and none ever will.
Susan, come in, dear, come in.
Oh, I'm sorry if I woke you, Father.
Oh, it's all right. What time is it?
It's just 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock? Oh, what are you doing up and dressed so early?
I'm driving up to the country to open our summer place. Have you forgotten, Father?
Oh, yes, there you are.
Oh, didn't you sleep well last night, Father? The circles under your eyes.
No, I spent a very poor night. I had a nightmare, but I can't seem to remember what it was about.
Oh, I'm sorry, Father. Tell me, is there anything I can get you?
No, I'll be all right, dear. You run along.
Oh, I need the keys to the car.
Oh, yes, you'll find them over there on my desk. And if you need any money, help yourself.
Oh, thank you, Father, but I have enough money.
Have you found the keys?
Oh, yes, here they are. Oh, do you want me to mail this letter on your desk?
What letter?
This one. It isn't addressed. All that's written on the envelope is one word. Urgent.
Urgent?
Yes, and it's in your handwriting, see?
Why, I never wrote that.
But, Father, it is your handwriting. And look, there are ink stains on your fingers. You must have written it before you went to bed.
But I tell you, I didn't. Let me see that letter. Yes, that's my handwriting, all right.
Oh, Father, I'm leaving now. I want to get there by noon.
What? Oh, yes. Goodbye, dear. Take care of yourself.
I will, darling. Bye.
Urgent. And it's my handwriting, all right. But for the life of me, I can't remember. Well, let's see. Dear Martin. What the devil? A letter in my own handwriting addressed to me. Dear Martin. No. No, this can't be. It can't.
Martin, is anything wrong? I came as quickly as I could. You sounded so upset over the phone.
Dr. Warren, I'm afraid my mind is giving way.
You, Martin? You're the last person in the world to become unbalanced.
Well, that's what I thought until I read this letter.
Letter?
Yes, and it's in my handwriting, so I must have written it.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
When I woke up an hour ago, this letter was on my desk. I could see it was my handwriting, and yet I don't remember having written it.
You don't remember having written it?
No, and yet I must have. There are still ink stains on my fingers.
Martin, none of this makes sense.
Yes, I know.
What's in the letter?
I'll read it to you. Dear Martin...
Wait a minute. You mean it's in your handwriting, but it's addressed to you.
Yes, but it's signed
with the name of my brother John.
Signed by John, in your writing.
Exactly.
You better read me that letter. Maybe then I can understand this.
Dear Martin, this letter will undoubtedly give you quite a shock.
But after you finish reading it, I'm quite sure you'll understand why it was written. After I left Susan and you a few hours ago, I went to keep my appointment with the dream interpreter I'd spoken to you about. It was shortly before midnight that I returned to my home. As usual, I found Martha and Paul waiting up for me.
Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. John.
Paul, Martha, what are you doing up so late? I told you never to wait up for me after 10 o'clock.
Well, we worry about you. You know what the doctor said about your heart.
You should have been in bed an hour ago.
You both treat me as though I were a 6-year-old.
And sometimes you act like one. Well, I have a glass of warm milk for you in the pantry.
I don't want any milk.
It's good for you. Here, let me have your coat.
Oh, thank you, Paul. It feels good to be home, sitting in the chair before the fire.
Here's your warm milk, Mr. John, and I want you to drink it down without any arguments. After all, it's for your own good. Here, take. Mr. John? Mr. John?
Martha, what's wrong?
Paul. Mr. John,
Mr. John. Mr. John. Answer me. He's dead.
Paul.
Now, please, Martha, please, you mustn't cry. The end came very quickly, peacefully. Not there, Martha, there.
It came as quite a shock, Martin, hearing myself declared dead, but as I saw my earthly body sitting in the armchair by the fireplace, I knew it was true. John Drake was dead. I wanted to comfort Paul and Martha, make them understand that only the body of John Drake was dead, that the spirit would live forever. I wanted to tell them that I was indescribably happy, for I knew without knowing how that on the following day I should be reunited with my dear wife, Judith. Then my thoughts turned to you, Martin, and in one brief moment, I saw your past, your present, and your future. Your future left me horrified, Martin, for in it I saw unhappiness. Unhappiness and death. I felt that somehow I had to warn you of what the future held. I left the house I had died in and went to your home. The radio was playing. You were sitting in an easy chair, reading a book, unaware of what the future held for you.
Martin! Martin, you must listen to me! Martin, look up from that book you're reading. You must.
But I couldn't reach you with my words. There was too great a distance between us. I stood by, helpless to aid you. A few minutes later, you yawned, closed the book, and turned off the radio. A half hour later, you were in bed and asleep. And then I suddenly had hope. I couldn't reach you while you were awake, Martin, but while you slept, perhaps I could reach your subconscious, warn you about the future. I saw your desk with writing paper on it, and I knew that was the only way to reach you. I spoke softly, trying to reach your subconscious. Martin, Martin, listen to me. This is John. You must hear me, for it's a matter of life and death. You must do exactly as I say. I want you to get out of bed. That's it. Throw back the covers. Now put your feet on the floor. Martin, do as I say. That's right. Now go to your desk. That's fine. Now sit down. That's it. Pick up the pen that's on the desk. Martin, pick up the pen. That's right. You picked up the pen and began to write as I dictated. Everything up to this point explains how this letter was written. And now, the reason for it. In looking into the future, I was horrified to see that Susan would die the night of June 7th, 1947, at exactly 6 o'clock. That means you must act swiftly, Martin, for she has less than 24 hours to live. If you don't, she will be found frozen to death. As for yourself, I see you dying as the result of an accident. in a small, roughly furnished room. In this room is a death calendar. And the date it shows as you lie dying is September 3rd, 1947. Martin, the love I bear you and your daughter has reached out from another world to warn you against the future.
I pray that you will act upon this information and save yourselves. Your brother, John.
That's the most extraordinary letter I ever heard.
Well, what do you make of it, Doctor?
You're sure this is your handwriting?
Certain of it. And then there are these ink stains on my fingers.
Yes. It's amazing.
It's obvious that I wrote this letter last night in my sleep. What upsets me is the content of the letter. The things I wrote are so fantastic that I'm afraid I may be losing my mind.
No. I'm quite sure you're sane, Martin.
Well, then how do you account for my writing such a fantastic letter even in my sleep?
Has it occurred to you that this fantastic letter, as you call it, may not be fantastic?
What? Now, Henry, you're not trying to tell me that you believe that this letter is true. That my brother John did die last night and came here to... Surely you don't believe in all that tommy rot.
Then your explanation for that letter is that you wrote it while having a nightmare?
Well, of course. What other answer could there be? It's ridiculous to think that you, a man of science, could attach any credence to this letter even for a moment. You amaze me.
There have been many phenomena in history. Phenomena that never could be explained. Not even by science.
Oh, you're almost as bad as my brother. Soon you'll be telling me that you, too, believe in spiritualism.
Have you called up your brother this morning?
Why, no. Why should I have? Oh, you think he may have died last night as he wrote me in this letter? Doctor, I think you'd better see a doctor.
I suggest you call your brother.
Well, all right, I will, just to show you what a fool you are for believing even for a moment that there can be anything to this letter. Why, when John was here last night, he looked just as healthy as... Paul, this is Mr. Drake. Is my brother there?
The what? Last night, after he returned home. I see. Thank you, Paul.
He is dead, isn't he?
Yes. Paul said that he died last night.
If your brother died last night, then this letter must have been written by him through your subconscious after...
No, that can't be. What you're saying is madness. The dead can't communicate with the living.
Yeah, but in this letter, your brother speaks of his death last night and goes on to tell...
My brother couldn't have written that letter through my subconscious. Such things can't happen.
I wish I felt as certain as you do. What about this part of the letter? In looking into the future, I was horrified to see that Susan would die the night of June 7th, 1947, at exactly 6 o'clock in the evening. That means you must act swiftly, Martin, for she has less than 12 hours to live. If you don't, she'll be found frozen to death.
And that proves how fantastic the whole letter is. Today is June 7th, and outside it's like summer. How could Susan possibly be frozen to death?
I don't know, Martin. But if Susan were my daughter, I think I'd want to be with her tonight at 6 o'clock. You'd never be able to forgive yourself if anything were to happen to her. I'll go with you if you like.
Oh. Very well, but mind you, I still don't believe that John wrote this letter through my subconscious.
What do you believe?
I believe it's a wonderful story.
I'm liking this. This is great. Why can't I get some great spirit to make me subconsciously write out the winning lotto numbers? Come on.
There you go. Now you're talking.
All right.
Money can't buy happiness, but it's a good down payment.
And can occasionally rent it, so, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you know. Just a lease, just a short-term lease. That works for me.
Yes. I was thinking more sinister thoughts.
Yeah.
But I digress.
Yeah, Maurice Toppin, who is the mysterious traveler, he also was the strange Dr. Weird, and he also was, he also was on Boston Blackie. He was Inspector Faraday, but he was on many other shows like Valiant Lady, which was a soap opera, The Shadow, Theater 5, The March of Time, as Winston's Churchill, Gangbusters, various soap operas, and looks like he also played Los Angeles District Attorney Richard Hanley on The Guiding Light. I think it was on television. On Mert and Marge, he played Barney Belzer, and he was in several episodes of Tom Corbett, Space Cadet.
Cadet.
Here we go.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering, I don't know when the comic of Dr. Strange started, but he was the strange Dr. Weird versus the weird Dr. Strange. So,
is there a connection?
I don't know.
You have to look that up.
Mysterious Traveler, one of my, they're in the top tier of my favorite radio horror hosts.
Yeah, because here he is just riding in his train, telling all these. And he had a lot of, back when nobody was doing science fiction, they were doing some science fiction. It really wasn't until the 50s that science fiction, adult stories, not like the Tom Corbett and the Flash Gordon and things like that, but the adult stories really didn't come into fashion until 1950. They were doing it before that.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And Mysterious Traveler was a popular in other forms of media. I think we've discussed that here before. There was a nice Mysterious Traveler movie, comic books. I think there was a magazine, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
so,
I think
those
magazines were some of the magazines when they had that, the comic book, purge when
that hated Dr. Wortham wrote the book The Seduction of the Innocent, which paralleled the Red Scare. You know, people can say things can swing too far one way or the other, not to get political, but I think there was just a rage of everything is wrong and we got to clamp down on everything, and they destroyed EC Comics. There were Senate hearings, and
that's why I think you occasionally hear that when people buy a house, they'll find in a wall a bunch of comic books.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking there may have been a bunch of kids who said, "Don't worry, Mom, I'll throw them out," and hid them somewhere in the wall. And now people are able to buy their house outright because
there's enough good stuff in there. They ended up going the way of the motion picture industry, where they agreed to self-regulate, and hence the Comics Code of Approval, which included all kinds of rules. The bad guys couldn't win initially. You know what I mean? No excessive blood. You couldn't even write the word Flick, F-L-I-C-K, for fear that in block letters, the L and I would run together, need I say more, I think not.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And if I may digress very briefly, it never stopped Wonder Woman from somehow getting caught up in her lasso or someone chaining her up. She always broke free. But what was with that? I mean, I know the guy who created her had a little fetish.
Yeah, there was.
On, but
there's a whole thing to that with some of the covers of those magazines in particular. Not just the bondage aspect. There were other, let's just say, pieces of imagery that were a bit on the racy side.
No kidding.
But, was I politically correct enough to describe that without getting us in trouble?
I think so.
Yeah.
Blog Talk will let you know.
Oh, no, they won't.
Yeah.
Probably can't even hear us.
What?
Yeah, they probably can't hear us.
They're making it hard for us to hear us.
Yeah. That wasn't what he said. It was just crackling noise from the fantastic reception that Blog Talk provides.
That's right. That's our escape clause. Sorry, that was static. I didn't say that.
Well, since you're British, That's just an American word. Doesn't mean a thing.
Yes. Yes. I'm sorry, we're British.
You're British. There you are. Team Crumpets.
Just like your voice, lady, who warns us how much time we have left. I'll be that British lady now. We got lots of time, but it would be fun to sneak in some extra radio. So why not wrap up this intriguing tale from Mysterious Traveler, Death Writes a Letter.
What time is it, Henry?
It's a few minutes after six.
If we hadn't had the breakdown, we'd have been there hours ago.
How much further is it?
As soon as we reach the top of this hill, you'll be able to see it.
I wish we'd reached the house before six.
Now, surely you don't believe what that letter says. How could Susan possibly freeze to death? Why, it's a warm evening. It's like summer.
Yes, I know, but just the same, I wish we'd arrived sooner.
Look, you can see the house now, down there in the valley. Susan's probably getting dinner. And we've certainly looked like a pair of fools coming up here because of that ridiculous letter.
I hope you're right.
Henry, Susan isn't in her room.
She isn't?
No.
Could she be in the village or a visiting friend?
No. You're forgetting her car is parked in front of the house.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, where can she be?
I'm afraid I can't answer that.
I'll search the second and third floors while you search this floor in the cellar. She must be someplace in the house. Henry, where are you?
Down in the cellar, Martin.
I searched every room on the second and third floor, but I couldn't find a sign of her.
I found her, Martin.
You found her? Well, where is she? Susan.
You must prepare yourself for a shock.
Shock?
Martin, listen to me. I found her in the cold storage room, frozen to death.
No. She can't be dead.
But she is, Martin. From what I could make out, she turned on the freezing system full and then went inside to store some meats, probably right after she got here. While she was in there, the door slammed shut and locked her in.
Oh, Susan. If only I'd gotten here in time.
Martin, for weeks now you've been like this. Now you must get hold of yourself. You'll break down. You did everything you could to save Susan.
No, that's just it. I didn't. John reached me from beyond the grave to warn me about the future, but I merely laughed. Had I heeded his letter, Susan would be alive today.
But, Martin, you did try to get there in time. It wasn't your fault the car broke down.
Yes, but if I'd believed in the letter, I'd have hired another car and kept going instead of waiting for my car to be repaired.
You know, I've been thinking, perhaps it was meant that your car should break down, that you should arrive too late to save Susan.
What?
Perhaps it was wrong of John to break through the barrier that separates the living from the dead and warn you of the future.
Well, how could it be wrong if it would have saved Susan?
Perhaps it was ordained that Susan was to die when she did. And that's why the car broke down.
No. I could have saved her if only I'd hired another car and rushed on to my country home. But at least now I can heed John's warning and save my own life.
Save your own life?
Yes. Have you forgotten the other part of the letter? As for yourself, Martin, I see you dying as the result of an accident in a small, roughly furnished room. In this room is a desk calendar, and the date it shows as you lie dying is September 3rd, 1947. Today is August 1st. That means I have less than 5 weeks to live, unless I can save myself.
Well, how can you save yourself, Martin? What's meant to be will be.
Not if I'm clever enough to take advantage of the information in this letter. Dying as the result of an accident in a small, roughly furnished room. Yes, but if John had only told me what kind of an accident it was meant to be. Well, nevertheless, come what may, I'm not going to die on September 3rd.
Just a minute.
Hey, Martin, what's going on? I mean, what's the meaning of all those men around the house? Why was I searched before I entered the room?
Henry, do you know what the date is?
Well, yes, it's September 2nd.
Yes, and in a few minutes it will be midnight, and then it will be September 3rd.
Oh, yes, that's right. The letter.
In the letter, John warns me that I shall die of an accident in a small, roughly furnished room. Well, you'd hardly call this drawing room that, would you?
No, I wouldn't.
It's my intention to remain in this room until tomorrow is past. Now, Henry, would you mind keeping me company for the next 24 hours?
No, Martin, not at all.
See, I've taken every possible precaution to prevent an accident from occurring. I've removed everything from this room but that sofa, chair, and table. And I have food in here to last me for several days. I have guards around this house and outside this room to prevent anyone from entering for the next 24 hours.
It certainly sounds as though you've taken every precaution.
Yes, I've done everything I could think of. Henry, do you hear that? It's just midnight. September 3rd is here.
Martin, will you stop looking at your watch every other second?
I can't help it. One more minute and it'll be midnight. And when the clock in the hallway strikes, it'll be September 4th.
Yes, Martin, yes. Now, why don't you sit down and take it easy?
How can I at a time like this?
Martin, you must calm down. Think of your heart.
Only 30 seconds more, Henry. 30 seconds.
Martin, you're as white as a sheet.
Well, who wouldn't be? I'm cheating death. I'm going to live. Live, do you hear?
Easy there now. I can't help feeling it would have been better if John hadn't warned you about the future.
No, don't say that. If he hadn't, I'd have been dead by now. Henry, do you hear that? It's midnight. And I'm still alive. Alive.
For some weeks, Martin Drake was a sick man as the result of the strain he'd undergone. But with the coming of fall, he was well on the road to recovery. It was in late autumn that he invited Dr. Warren to go hunting with him in Maine. Day after day, the two men, with their guide, roamed the woods. The exercise and outdoor life did Martin a world of good, and he was soon his former self, both physically and mentally.
It seems to be getting much colder, doesn't it?
Yes, it feels very much like snow.
I think it'll hold off for a while yet. Would you like to do a little more hunting, Mr. Drake? We still got a couple of hours till it gets dark.
Yes, I wouldn't mind. How about you, Henry?
Well, by all means. Maybe we'll come across that buck we spotted this morning.
Yes, he was a big fellow. Where'd I put my rifle?
Here it is, Mr. Drake, under the tree.
Oh, yes, so it is.
Here's your rifle, Doc.
Right. This rifle of mine...
Oh. Martin, what happened?
Good grief, he shot himself, Doc.
Martin, are you badly hurt?
The gun went off when I picked it up. My shoulder.
Easy now. Well, I have a look at it.
Oh.
Is it bad, Doc?
Oh.
No, not bad. We must get him to a shelter and stop this bleeding.
Ed Tolliver's place, about a quarter of a mile from here, Doc.
All right, give me a hand.
We gotta get him there at once.
Now, put him down gently on the cot.
Okay.
Easy now. That's it.
How is he, Doc? Think he'll pull through?
Yeah, of course he's... just fainted from the pain and the loss of blood. Now, let's see.
Sure is a nasty wound.
Yeah. Fortunately, the bullet went on through his shoulder. I won't have to probe for it.
Oh.
What are you going to do to him, Doc?
Well, first I'll have
Henry,
to...
Henry, where am I?
Now, just lie still, Martin. We brought you to this shack where I can fix you up.
Oh, my shoulder hurts.
It'll be all right now once I get the bullet wound cleaned up. Pete, put my medical bag on this desk here. Open it, will you?
Sure, Doc.
Will you have to probe for the bullet?
No. Fortunately, it went right through. All I have to do is clean the wound. It may hurt a bit, Martin.
That's all right, Henry. Go ahead.
Maybe you better turn your face away from me so you won't see what I'm doing. Sometimes it's easier that way. Concentrate on the desk over there, huh?
All right.
Pete, hand me that tube of sulfur powder.
Yep.
Also the...
Henry!
What is it, Martin?
That... calendar.
What calendar?
There on the desk. Don't you see?
Yes.
Do you see what date it has? September 3rd.
Well, I guess that's the day Ed Tolliver went back to the city.
September 3rd.
Oh, Martin, you mustn't get excited.
Do you remember what the letter said?
Henry, this is it.
Oh, Martin, no, you'll be all right if only you'll count.
I had an accident. This room is small, roughly furnished, and the desk calendar does show September 3rd, 1947. Henry, it's all as John said it would be. I haven't cheated death. He's here in this room. He's come to take me. He's come to...
Doc, what's wrong?
He's dead.
Dead? But it was only a shoulder wound. You said he'd pull through.
Yes, but I was wrong. Shock killed him. I guess nothing can save a man when it's ordained he die. Death came to Martin Drake as it was foredoomed to come. About Martin and Susan, wasn't it? Even John Drake's warning from another world couldn't save them, which seems to prove that when your time comes, nothing you can do can change it. So you might as well not worry about it. So I did know of a man who managed to outwit death for several hundred years. Then one day he was... Oh, you'll have to get off here. I'm sorry. But I'm sure we'll meet again. I take this same train every week at this time.
You have just heard The Mysterious Traveler, a series of dramas of the strange and terrifying. In today's story, all the characters were fictional, and any resemblance to the name of an actual person, living or dead, was purely coincidental. In the cast were Maurice Tarplin, Roger DeCoven, Eric Dressler, and Bryna Rayburn. Original music was played by Paul Taubman. The Mysterious Traveler is written, produced, and directed by Robert J. Arthur and David Kogan. Listen next week to a tale titled...
Death is My Co-Pilot.
Another strange and suspenseful tale of the mysterious traveler. Your mysterious traveler has turned author. Yes, Maurice Tarplin has penned a chilling tale titled Seven Casks of Death, which appears in the current issue of Dime Mystery Magazine, one of the popular publications group now on sale at your local newsstand. Don't miss it.
Dime Magazine, with the nickel.
This program has come to you from our New York studios. Another program of tense and dramatic action will follow in just a minute. Stay tuned to the station for Official Detective. Carl Caruso speaking. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
There you go with the mysterious traveler and a cool story.
Very cool. But even though you learned a story from that, you could still learn something besides that on the story.
Yeah, one could learn to be prepared.
Let me get those strolling.
Eerie House Radio timidly presents a garlic moral of the story.
It's apologies to Gar. This story proves once and for all that you cannot cheat death. But if you're lucky, you can get to him to put you on the installment plan instead.
There you go, Slim. Thank you. How'd you like that one, CW?
I enjoyed that. I loved it. I mean, is it, you know, you're fulfilling your own destiny, a fulfillment of a prophecy, or was his friend really able to help him? He just didn't believe enough, or, you know, it's just, you go round and round and round. I liked it. For example, if my friend says, you know, from the great beyond, you're going to win the lotto, and if I don't believe them, will I not win the lotto because I didn't believe them, or will I not win the lotto because I did believe them but didn't play it right, or did this and that and the other thing? Yeah, my head's spinning right now, so I need an aspirin.
With all the technical difficulties, we didn't have a whole lot of extra time, but here's a tune.
The King's Men singing Put On Your Old Gray Bonnet.
When my great-great-grandpa went a-spooning, he bought a diamond for a dollar, wore a celluloid collar, and he spent the evening crooning. Put on your old gray bonnet with some blue ribbons on it, and we'll hitch old Dobbin to the shade. Through the fields of clover we will ride to Dover on our golden wedding day. Now, Grandpa on my father's side was tough. He never knew the meaning of a beer. He liked his cider hard, his living rough. For Grandpa was a rugged pioneer. Put on your old coon skin or shoot a buffalo for dinner, and we'll get on west along the trail.
Yeehaw.
If the posse tries to catch us, we'll have posse stew for breakfast, or we'll wind up back in jail. Mother was a lady of society, and father was a master of propriety. He sought to romance her. She gave him the answer with a kiss like this. Put on your new silk copper, get the town car from Papa, bring the news photographers today. And tomorrow, if the rotos print some fascinating photos, we will set the wedding day. So now we come to me, the latest branch on the family tree. You know it's great game to be alive. Dig, dig this jive. Put on your Bobby socks. Let's go jumping where the music rocks. Knocks your heart a-bumping and you take your vitamin pills to keep you from swooning away. So let's shake your shoulders, 'cause we're gonna hate it when we're older.
I can't remember exactly which episode, but there was a Warner Brothers cartoon where, like, I think a wolf or something portrays this song, The Old Gray Bonnet.
Oh, okay. Okay.
like most
crazy
Warner Brothers, extremely absurd situation. Yeah. Speaking of absurd, we'll be back tomorrow night.
Yeah.
With CBS Radio Mystery Theater. I thought it was one of the missing. Apparently not.
Nope.
That's a whole other story. No, tomorrow night Postage Due from CBS Radio Mystery Theater.
Yes.
That's tomorrow night at 6:30 Eastern. Right here.
Yes.
Yes.
On Erie House.
E.G. Marshall.
Amen.
E.G. Marshall, exactly.
Yeah. He did most of them, not all of them, but most of them.
He did most all of them up until
last couple of years,
maybe. In 82, which was the last year. I think Tammy Grimes took over for the last maybe year and a half. I'd have to look that up for sure.
Oh, wow.
Did her share of them, but they just weren't quite the same as E.G. Marshall. And she didn't get quite, I think they were kind of running out of stories, the writers were, it seems, so.
Well, they had a hell of a run.
They did. Absolutely.
All right. Well, we just chatted our way right through Vincent Price, so we'll see you tomorrow at 6:30 Eastern.
Oh,
got distracted. Good night, folks.
Thanks,
and
everybody.
Good luck in prison.
Good night.
Night. Night. Still night.
There you go, polka time.
There you go.
There we go.
All right, it's out. There we go.
A swell
show. Well, that was
show,
a challenge
thanks.
Tonight.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And just want to say out there to our Gar, you know, rest well, get better, healing vibes and all that.
Yep.
And kicking the pants to Blog Talk Radio for kicking me out of the phone bank.
And doing what it, whatever
in.
It may have done to me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I have to check. Well, it might be self-inflicted.
Yeah. Hey,
so,
Dale, we'll have to talk tomorrow before we go on. That way you can check out how you can change your settings there through Audacity.
Oh, I tried.
Okay. Okay.
I did a couple settings and got nowhere, and I even tried another headset. So we'll just see what happens. It might be that maybe I got disconnected briefly, which might have locked me out since I'm logged in to the studio.
Are you,
that could be.
Are your headsets on a plug or are they wireless?
On a plug.
Your plug may not have already been pushed all the way into the socket.
Tried that.
Did that? Okay.
Yeah.
Tried another headset to make sure wires weren't loose or whatever.
Maybe you need to vacuum out the cat
headset.
Hair.
Huh?
Yeah, vacuum out the cat hair.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not too bad over here.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, you have a gaming set. Oh, I'm jealous. Wow.
No, I bought a set in a panic last time I had audio problems, if Dave remembers. And I'm like, I didn't need to buy it because I love the headsets that I normally use. I think it broadcasts fairly well. But I bought these in a panic, and I thought, well, I'll just keep them then. I got a spare if this one does crash for good.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, I must be away, and with your permission, I'll call our wonderful world-renowned pianist to the stage, Mr. Durante. Would you be so kind?
I'll bet he would.
Good night. Good night. Good
night. Wow, wow.
It's time to say good night.
Wow, wow, wow.
Good night. Good night.
Wow, wow, wow.
What more is this say but good night?
Wow, wow, wow.
We've had a few laughs, and it's time for toodaloo. Sorry, go up, we the same. And
in
could
think
to do. Good night. Good night.
No, no.
Good night, folks. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Wherever.
Boom, boom, boom.